And good morning to you. June 29th, Monday morning. Welcome to another live broadcast day here at KMUD, legally known as Redwood Community Radio, KMUD Garberville, 91.1 FM and HD1. KMUE Eureka, 88.1 and HD1. KLAI Laytonville, broadcasting at 90.3 FM. And translator K258BQ Shelter Cove at 99.5 FM. Our studios and offices are located at 1144 Redway Drive in Redway, California, 95560. Some of today's programming has been pre-recorded. The views and opinions expressed throughout the broadcast day are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or underwriters. Time will be made available for other viewpoints. And thanks for joining us this morning. We've got Monday Morning Magazine with your host, Richard Ginger, right coming up next. But first, let me say support for your voice in the Redwoods comes from Gold Rush Coffee, located in Petrolia, roasted in the earthquake capital of Humboldt County. Gold Rush Coffee is available at stores and restaurants all over the North Coast. And support for KMUD comes from Wildberries Marketplace, offering spaces to dine in for breakfast, lunch, and dinner on the patio or at the smoothie bar. Locally owned and operated, Wildberries is open every day till midnight at the top of the hill on G Street in Arcata. More information is at wildberries.com. I think we're all caught up. We're going to turn it over to Richard Ginger for Monday Morning Magazine.
Thank you, BR.
Sure thing.
I would like to say I'm actually co-hosting with David Simpson. And when you call Bill Eastwood and he's here, we'll have a, sort of a three co-host kind of thing going on. Jerry Clemenson has been away for a couple of weeks. And there was two Monday Morning Magazine slots that were not, that she couldn't find hosts for and programming. So there was some interesting canned stuff last week, and I thought maybe this is a good opportunity to try and bring together a number of people that have been vital to our region and some beyond in the realm of, quote, restoration, unquote. So how to put together a show that is comprehensible for the general public, so to speak, and not get lost in the weeds, as they say, is can be demanding. So I'm going to try and get started off. I think Bill's on the line here, too. Bill?
Yeah.
All right.
Hey, Bill.
So I'm going to try and set a little scene here, Bill, and then David and you can... weigh in. One thing that is common with all the participants today is they have all hard sought to earn a living in the old sense of right livelihood through doing things that restore land and wildlife from adverse impacts. So this is part of a consciousness that came out of most recently out of the 60s with all the passage of these environmentally protective and review type legislation. Ironically, a lot of them federally were signed by Richard Nixon. But when we came into this country as mostly back to landers and tried to address the conditions and everything, people were looking for another model everywhere. These hillsides had been scarred almost entirely by caterpillars in the boom time after World War II. And I'll mention this probably again, but a lot of this stuff was set off by a state policy that after World War II and ad valorem tax, you were taxed on your standing timber until you cut 70% of it. And these economic drivers...
It was really a big incentive to log.
Big incentive, you know. And... these economic drivers are sort of the scene we came into and trying to earn a living to make corrections there. It's really quite deep, actually. You're really trying to address cultural malaise of colonialism.
Well, yeah, you have to see it in a historic context, because I remember the moment that a light bulb went off in my mind, and I think it went off similarly in many people's ways of looking at the world, was that the whole trend of civilizations over the past 3,000, 4,000 years has been towards destroying watersheds.
Oh, no, earning a living.
destroying watersheds in the process of earning a living.
Or conquering other people.
In 1974, we had just moved to Petrolia from southern Humboldt. I had lived at the headwaters of the Mattole and seen gigantic salmon spawning in these small little pools and had been impressed. But when we moved down to the lower Mattole, you got a different picture, because you saw in the river bar, the history of land management over the last 40 years was clearly written. And it was a shock, because at that particular time I was working on a piece of writing called Meat, about meat production. And it was about how we had been managing the watersheds. And I had this recognition. I had been reading historical texts about how land had been managed in the Mesopotamian Valley and Babylonia and the Holy Land and Rome and Italy, all these Mediterranean cultures, which had been the heart of civilization, how they had been managed over the past 3,000 years, and how all the great civilizations of the past had basically gone into decline or absolutely disappeared. And it had happened the same way in almost every circumstance, in almost every country, in every civilization: overlogging and overgrazing in the uplands, and consequent silt-related flooding in the lowlands, and rendering the agricultural capacities of the alluvial terraces at the bottom of these watersheds infertile, to the point where there was no longer the ability to supply the civilization. And I was watching, this was a shock to me, I was looking out over the Mattole River bar. We live right near the mouth of the river, and looking at a floodplain that had been massively impacted hydrologically by the huge impacts of sediment that had come off the slopes in the past, 40 years during the boom.
And the 55 and 64 floods.
And the 55 and 64 floods, absolutely. They were crucial 200-year storms we haven't, that happened back-to-back in one decade. So, but I had to deal with this recognition that here we were, modern creatures, repeating the mistakes that civilization had been making for all these generations. And it used to take a lot more time to destroy a watershed than it does now. Of course, we have equipment. We have heavy equipment. We have German chainsaws, Caterpillar tractors. We could do things a lot faster and a lot more thoroughly, which seems to have happened.
One of the things that directly, Bill could speak to this as you see fit, Bill, but one of the inspirations to me was people like Bill Eastwood and Gerald Myers were putting together this Redwood Creek Renewal Project. And Bill, why don't you describe how you came into the country, so to speak, and you guys' reactions to all we saw around you?
Yeah, looking back on that period, I was reading a lot of that same stuff, David.
Soil and civilization was
there. Yeah, yeah. But we knew there were problems. The land, when we bought it here, while it was really beautiful, it was also cut over, and there was a lot of slash all over the place, and the streams were a mess. We could see that. We didn't have what I regard now as a better perspective on the influence of humans on our forests. We couldn't see back to white contact and what happened after that. I'm just kind of looking at all of that stuff right now. That a lot of the trees that were logged back in the 60s and all, they were actually post-contact trees.
They got their start after 1851.
Yeah, they started in the 1860s or so, and they were reasonably large trees during the logging period.
If they had invaded meadowland prior to the coming of the
exactly, yeah.
Shortly after the coming of the whites.
Yeah, right now I'm looking at oak woodlands on our land that are disappearing really fast, and doing oak woodland restoration now. I'm actually cutting down some fir trees that I probably planted back then.
You're putting wood in the streams that you took out.
And no, actually, I was really lucky. We started doing stream restoration work kind of right at the very end of that period where everybody was just going crazy, pulling wood out.
Tearing wood out of the water, yeah.
Yeah, there was a classic example of this in Whitmore Grove where there was a small tree trunk that was sticking out into the creek zone about, I don't know, 6 feet, you know, and the stream width right there was maybe 60 feet or so, and there was a red flag hanging on it, meaning that this was a potential problem and needed to be cut off. It was kind of a joke with us, but that's what was going on back then.
Well, you know, it may be important to put it into a context. I mean, our efforts at restoration were to a certain degree the product of our recognition of how much the land had been changed, but it also was the vehicle, the means by which we began to understand the complexities and the realities of, you know, the natural systems around us.
Right.
It was our way into the watersheds that simply, you know, that wasn't available simply by buying a piece of cutover forest land, but trying to understand what the land was doing and trying to see it in the larger context, which was meaningful, which was watersheds, really began to alter our understanding of the territory and deepen it over the years. I mean, we made many, many mistakes and misinterpretations, and we still are, but we're honing in on, you know, what the reality of what these watersheds are, the hydrological and geological realities.
Yeah.
And biological realities. Sorry, go ahead, Bill. I didn't mean to interrupt. I just want to put it in that context.
Well, one thing that I would like to point out here is that a lot of people have this notion that the that what was done with bulldozers and logging back in the 60s that it's basically healed. I mean, you can drive by on 101 and the hills are all green and beautiful, but the scars are still there, and the erosion problems are very often still there. I've got stuff on our land that really needs a lot of work, where they were dragging logs right down streams, and they're still having problems, lots of erosion.
You know, yeah. One of the examples I use is Stanley Creek, it's a west side tributary of the South Fork Eel, mm-hmm. just upstream of Piercy, and I won't get into all the details of the partnerships and everything that went on, but basically there's been six phases of restoration, much of it funded by the fisheries grant program of Fish and Wildlife, but also cost share by the two different landowners there. And it's up to over $2 million grant funding and cost shares to just deal with the roads in a 4,500-acre watershed. And there's watersheds.
That's just one small watershed.
That's not dealing with the in-stream habitat work that needs to be done.
Well, let me emphasize one thing here. The recovery of the conifer forest has been, at least in the lower Mattole, and I think elsewhere, is rather spectacular. In terms of tree regeneration, there's a new forest growing very rapidly.
And almost becoming merchantable as soon as it hits 16 inches.
It is becoming merchantable, which means we could have another wave of intense harvest. But more important, it itself does not complete the recovery of these watersheds. These underlying physical hydrological problems are still enormous. So we can, it's easy to be deceived by the recovery of the forest, which is great. I mean, I'm glad to see the regeneration that's happening. But at the same time, the underlying problems, the underlying disturbances are still there.
Yeah, this guy, Professor Gray from University of Wisconsin, I think, civil engineer, he wrote several books about hydrology and erosion and whatnot. But he came, he was brought into the Stafford slide situation, which was that big landslide that luckily didn't kill anybody. That came
destroyed
down, torrented,
the town of Stafford.
Torrented in the 96, 97 New Year's storms. And he referred to deranged hill slope hydrology. Now, this area is unstable. There's a dynamic equilibrium going on,
right,
you know, between the rainfall and the earthquakes. You know, canyons like Whale Gulch were formed pretty spectacular, among other features, you know. And so there was an equilibrium, though, until so-called contact and then the Industrial Revolution after World War II especially. Well, and then there was logging before then, you know.
Yeah.
You know, like the Big River was dammed.
A lot of the redwood forest in southern Humboldt had been logged before.
But they couldn't get it as fast as the caterpillar and the chainsaw and people that this is the economic boom going on. So that hydrology that was completely upset, there's streams that run horizontally across mountainsides because streams jumped our banks, followed a logging road, and went down to the next stream a half mile away or something. It's like pretty spectacular. And those things need to be dealt with. And then that's what a lot of us have been trying to do, is trying to earn a living through healing, sort of that kind of process.
You could call that right livelihood, perhaps.
You could. That's kind of thing. And the thing is, it's interesting in my personal case, is there's a certain pride and I guess emotionless, you know, moving large objects and being productive, whether it's, you know, plowing a field or moving trees out of the forest, and to use a lot of that testosterone kind of energy and to move in trees into the places it needs to increase habitat, to do things that require a lot of energy and forethought and action, to not just extract and get the hell out and get your payday.
And that's a whole different way of dealing with the countryside.
All of our guests here today are of the male persuasion, but a lot of this stuff, and as we go on in future series, we'll bring some of the women in that have been really important to all this. But just sort of like trying to rebalance the masculine and the feminine approach to people and landscape.
Yeah, right.
Because the print on our terrain has been largely,
and this is radical, because at no time in history had restoration of natural systems been chosen as the prime. We've destroyed watersheds, we've not put them back together.
One of the things too, though, there is examples of restoration going back way in time. Evan Engberg down at Bioengineering Associates, his inspiration came from the Chinese bioengineering devices to save soil.
So did Tasha McKee. So did much of Tasha McKee's.
That's right, in India
terms
too.
Of saving water.
Yeah, yep.
She learned from it in India. So the remnants of the ancient tribal cultures still provide us with many of our examples, and we just have to respect them and look for them.
Yeah, I was having a chance to look at this article, but I don't know how many people know of David Suzuki. In British Columbia, he's sort of like the Wendell Berry, Gary Snyder, and the Dow all rolled into one. But he was apparently wrote some article that the salvation of people on Earth lies through following indigenous ways, not so-called environmentalism. Because a lot of environmentalism is trying to make the dominant cultures nicer, softer, in terms of that exploitation. So we need to do something that's really substantive, and that's what we've been fortunate to do to some degree, is to make an efforts in restoration. For instance, the Mattole Restoration Council is, at one time, was the largest employer in the Mattole Valley. There's so much that needs to be done, and the problem comes in matching the funds, and so much of that has come from bond issues and whatnot, not to get into the weeds too quick here.
Right.
Yeah, if you had anything else to say, I think that Sun Noam Madrone is going to be
Sun Noam will be here in a couple minutes.
Yeah.
I'm going to call him up. So, Bill, do you have anything to add right now?
One thing that just popped into my head was that the work in Redwood National Park was kind of a driver here for working out a lot of restoration techniques. They purchased that whole mountainside of logged over redwoods. In what year was that? It must have been about
64, 65.
Well, then they expanded it. And the expansion was a big deal.
Yeah, so they actually bought a really trashed forest. I mean, the amount of disturbance was just overwhelming. I mean, it was staggering.
Yeah, almost as staggering as P.L. Maxam's. It's the same thing, really.
Yeah. I mean, whole hillsides just completely clear-cut of huge trees. And virtually every square inch disturbed in some way.
Incredible.
So, and it was all of a sudden, this one guy, Steve Veers, who was a national park ecologist, I think, he was given the job of restoring this forest, you know. And at that time, there was virtually no... no restoration culture, no techniques that anybody
knew much about.
There was one kind of humorous thing that happened with us in Bryceland. The Redwood Creek Renewal Project had been started largely by Gerald Myers. And we were going to restore the watershed, and we were doing some things, mainly focusing on kind of small level stuff like working on gullies and stuff like that by hand, and Steve Veers and some Redwood National Park folks came down to see what we were doing. I mean that was the level of understanding of restoration back then. You know, they were groping. They were really groping around, like, what do we do here anyway?
They were looking for a preface. So
yeah.
in this light, Bill, I'm really glad you brought that up. One, Sun Gnome was involved in a lot of that, and
right, he was.
That expansion. And then our last person going to be on the show today is Bill Weaver.
Yes, he can add a lot, because he was one of the PhD types that got drug in and started looking at all this stuff and realizing that they needed to start using big equipment to fix big problems. I mean that was kind of their big insight there.
What hath wrought the damage needs to fix the damage. So Sun Gnome, how are you this morning?
Good, well.
Good. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
So I bet you have a foundation story.
A restoration. Yeah, always.
More than one foundation? Oh my gosh!
What brought you into restoration, Sun Gnome? When and what brought you into it?
Well, growing up as a young kid, you know, people ask you, "What are you going to be when you grow up?" And I always would tell people, "I want to be a forest ranger." I was a Boy Scout and used to go up into the Sierras into Mammoth before it became overrun, and so that's often what I thought I wanted to do, and people would say, well, you should go to Humboldt State, because it was well known as a forestry school already at that point in the 60s. And so I ended up coming to Humboldt in 1973 and very quickly ran into a very fine gentleman by the name of Dr. Rudolph Becking, teaching in the forestry department at Humboldt State. Although Rudy did get booted from the department because he was teaching the kinds of forestry that we're now just embracing 40 years later, that he was teaching all-age management and forest ecology, fire ecology in the Redwoods, all kinds of great stuff. So I joined in with him and a bunch of other folks, Randy Stemler and others, that were involved in a group called the Emerald Creek Committee. And our group was the primary driver behind helping make the Redwood National Park expansion actually happen. A lot of the national environmental groups had kind of gone past the Redwoods. They felt they had gotten their park in 1968, which actually did not add very much old-growth redwood other than Lady Bird Johnson Grove.
You want to explain the
and
worm?
It had the infamous Go ahead.
Want to explain the worm, that expansion, how important the expansion was because of the encroachment uplands to the destroying the equilibrium of Redwood Creek?
Yeah, absolutely. That was the other part. They had Lady Bird Johnson Grove, and then they ran a quarter mile wide on either side of the creek, so a total width of a half mile wide up Redwood Creek to include the Tall Trees Grove, where the tallest, the tallest trees in the world had been found. And of course, you can't just protect the bottom of the watershed. And they had learned that lesson, you would have thought, at Bull Creek, where they had tremendous fires and logging above the Rockefeller Forest back in the 50s. And then the 55 flood tore that watershed apart. And here we are in 68, creating a Redwood National Park, and once again thinking we can simply protect the bottom along the creek and let the rest of the watershed be logged over and unraveled with roads, etc. So that happened in Redwood Creek, and so there was a major push to try and protect the old growth in Redwood Creek around Redwood National Park and make that happen. And some of the studies being done by USGS were providing some great scientific basis for why that needed to happen and the threats to the old growth redwood via flooding, where you would deposit gravels up onto the alluvial terraces. And when you deposit cobbles and gravels on those terraces, you can actually kill the old growth redwoods. So there was a major push, but the science alone wasn't enough to get the park expanded. It really happened because of a bunch of activists, like the Emerald Creek Committee, just continuing to hammer away at it and document a lot of the damage and problems. And we ultimately were able to discover a lot of the archaeological sites in the Bald Hills. No digging, no disturbing, just simply ocular observation and working with an insider at the State Historic Office of Preservation in Sacramento. And we were able to file papers for all of the archaeological sites in Redwood National Park that are now part of the park that were in the Bald Hills.
What years were those?
So there was just momentum growing.
What years were those approximately?
That was in 76, 77. So, as I said, I came into the area in 73, joined the Emerald Creek Committee, and in 1978, the park finally got expanded, and it included a watershed restoration bill.
Yeah, thank you for doing that. You know that was a very hard time. Boy, there was a lot of hard feelings just all over the place back
remember
then.
Remember the Straight Arrow Coalition?
Yeah.
Can't forget.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was... If somebody has a livelihood and they're used to doing something for a livelihood and they see that's a threat, they're gonna mess somebody up.
Yeah.
And there are crazy things going on. Somebody or somebody's going up and down 101 and mutilating old growth trees they could get to off the highway.
Yeah.
You know, so bad, many of them, that they had to be cut down.
A lot of serious misunderstandings.
And a lot of the powers that be really encouraged that, you know, and then we go on up through the history with Headwaters and Judy Berry and Daryl Turney and Luna and all of it, you know, and
divide and conquer
people. Yeah,
I remember once sitting in front of the Petrolia store. I was talking with a guy named Sonny Henson, who was an old tree faller, retired big guy, and a young man came pulling up with a vehicle to get gas, and he had a Straight Arrow Coalition sticker, you know, bumper sticker on his car. And Sonny stood up and said, "Hey, we don't want your kinds around here. You know, we don't need your goddamn environmentalists, you know, telling us what to do with our timber." And the guy was totally bewildered. I said, Sonny, he's on your side. Oh? Anyway, a lot of misunderstandings, a lot of cultural misunderstandings.
Yeah, incredible cultural struggles that are still going on, that have been going on, and they're tied into all kinds of things that make more news than some of the stuff that we're describing. But some deep-rooted things, desperation of earning a livelihood in a colonial kind of attitude. You know, the big timber companies, they got, people to do homesteads. You had some particular things, and then they turned over their small holdings, and people conglomerated into these huge holdings. The Pacific Lumber, I think, was one of them, into these places that in the 20th century, you just didn't buy property like Boise Cascade did when they bought Union Lumber. You bought the whole town, all the people that ran everything that made it work. You know, it's like that's some feudalism revisited.
Feudalism, and the people who provided the labor for all this were, you know, just hardworking, you know, folks without a lot of options. And they were more or less forced into the position of defending the interests of the large timber companies.
It's still going on in different forms.
Still going on.
Anyway.
One of the things that has to be a concern is that, like Bill emphasized, you know, the underlying geology is still there. The underlying damage is still, much of it is still there undealt with. But it's important to note that we're now, right, since 2007, there has been a relative curtailment of timber harvest in most of the watersheds in Northern California, simply because with the recession, the market wasn't there. The price of timber wasn't sufficient to make it pay. But now you're starting to see log trucks rolling again. I doubt that it's going to be a boom because the economy has not recovered to that point. But the danger is if the economy does recover, which we all want on some level, we're going to see a lot more damage done in the woods because there is some regenerated forest. There's a lot of young fir that is now commercially valuable. And really the regulations, as hard as people like Richard and others have worked over the years, the regulations are still not adequate to protect the watershed.
We need inspiration and good guidance. Regulations can only give you some sideboards. So, BR, you want to give a little half-hour cane mud update?
Sure thing, Richard. Thanks so much. And we'll be right back to Monday Morning Magazine in just a minute with guest hosts today, Richard Ginger, David Simpson, Bill Eastwood on the phone. We've got Sonome Madrone on the line and many more to come, including Supervisor Estelle Fennell. So it's 7:30 in the morning. You're listening to Monday Morning Magazine right here on KMUD. And support for KMUD comes from Bogart Extractors, manufacturers of closed-loop essential oil extraction systems. Announcing the grand opening of their retail store on July 1st, 142 West 4th Street in Eureka. The new Bogart Extractors retail store features ovens, accessories, apparel, and all your extraction needs. More information is available online at Bogart, BHOGART.com, or by phone 855-553-3887.
Okay, Sonome or Bill or David, maybe we should do a little recap of some of the excitement of those times that included the Hodads in Oregon and the founding of the Mattole Salmon Group and Mattole Restoration Council and related matters.
Well, who would you like to start with? Bill, you want to?
Yeah, well, I think David should start because the Mattole was a major leading force here.
And Sonome was there, right, Sonome?
Yeah,
betcha.
You guys did so much.
Well, we started, you know, it started from really simple origins. To a certain degree, some of it was pushed by, you know, the fact that we were looking for that right livelihood. And certainly the small parcels that we had been sold post-logging did not offer us adequate employment or, potential commercial importance. But in the Mattole, the project I really believe started with Mill Creek, a small tributary in the lower Mattole that had a coho run of some substance. The old timers talked about the silver sides, they called them. And they said there was a tremendous run of silver sides up Mill Creek, but there wasn't any longer. And we identified a culvert that had been replaced after the 64 flood at too steep a grade was the problem. It had blasted out a scour pool below the culvert that had made it impossible for even steelhead to get into the culvert and up into the stream to spawn. So it effectively curtailed the run due to a simple misunderstanding of gravity, really. And Mill Creek was protected. About a quarter of the watershed was still in old growth fir. And so we set out to try to figure out how we could restore a coal run to Mill Creek. And in the process, there were several meetings. The commercial fishermen got involved. The state was not involved yet on any level. We tried to apply pressure to the Department of Fish and Game, as it was called then, to deal with this issue of the culvert, which was just above the mouth into the Mattole. And slowly but surely, the wheels turned, and they forced the county to do something. We began to take measures, which ended up eventually 20 years later in a bridge. But trying to figure out how to bring the coho back to Mill Creek was the really provoked the whole program, because we went from there we took the leap. We began to understand how impacted the runs had been. We knew about watersheds. We knew, you know, because of our intellectual backgrounds, as it were, our cultural and intellectual backgrounds. We knew that watershed disrepair was at the heart of things, habitat disrepair. But we also discovered some tools, one of which was the small hatch box, like a mini hatchery that could be applied locally, applied by local people. This is very important to us because we, the people living in the watersheds, the new occupants, the re-inhabitants, were best situated to understand and care about what was going on. The Department of Fish and Wildlife was tremendously there was too much demand on too limited resources. So it fell back to us, the people living in the watersheds, to take some responsibility to try to figure out how to repair some of the damage that had been done. Anyway, we developed a small hatch box. We tried to sell it to the state. There was resistance. We got some help from Huey Johnson, the director of the Secretary of Resources.
This is when Governor Brown, in his first set of terms, was young and idealistic.
That's right, 76. And so we finally got some motion from the state to let us set up this, to actually take adult salmon and take eggs and milt according to established hatchery techniques, but on a small level. And we constructed some of these small hatch boxes on several different places, several different tributaries of the Mattole, and began to take eggs. And we found, you know, we were able to return almost 90% of the fish of the eggs we took as healthy young fry. This was an innovation. Of course, we didn't know that it presented some genetic dangers, concentrating the genes of too few parents and too many fish, but it was the people of the watershed who took this on.
It was incredible. Like, it was like a triumvirate, right? Freeman House and David, and then when Gary Peterson came on board with his expertise, things moved along. To get civilians able to handle fish and do all this, a huge responsibility, and it's an amazing saga that this was taken on, and Bill and Harry Vaughn and Redwood Creek were involved too, and down in Mendocino, Nat Bingham and other people were doing similar things, and it was
we all knew about each other. We weren't really comparing notes that closely, but we all knew that something was going on, and it was going on everywhere pretty much the same time. It just so happened that we got a hold of this hatchbox program and initiated it. Redwood Creek Renewal was a major force. A guy named Nat Bingham, a commercial fisherman, had brought the commercial fishermen, you know, mewling and screaming into a sense of that they had some relationship and responsibility to the watersheds from which their fish were coming. So, and then, of course, there was Redwood National Park, which was doing the first real systematic, scientific-based road and watershed.
You were involved in that first year of rehab work in the Redwood National Park. At Miko Oona and a whole bunch of different people from up and down the coast were involved in doing the small-scale kind of thing, like check dams and willow wattles and all that to prevent erosion?
Yeah, you know, Bill alluded to it earlier in talking about the Redwood Creek Renewal Project. And the park staff, once the national park was expanded in 1978, actually the year before in 1977, park staff like Bill Weaver, Danny Higgins, and
Terry Sprider
had arrived on the West Coast to help try and figure out what to do about Redwood Creek. And many of them were bachelor's or master's students. Most of them were not PhDs yet. And nobody had really done this thing. So they were searching around for ideas, and they ended up doing three pilot projects in 1977. One of them was on the Whiskey 40, a very notorious clear cut up on the Lady Bird Johnson Grove, where loggers came in before the park was created and fell of 30, 40 acres of old-growth redwood drunk on whiskey one night, so it got laid with the Whiskey 40. But I believe the Redwood Creek Renewal Group, Bill and others, did some work
on that unit with some
thinning and some using the thinning wood as little check dams in some of the gullies and things. Bob Warner, who was working with the Jacoby Creek Canyon community, ended up doing a project below Airport Prairie with a bunch of different labor-intensive approaches. And then I joined in with the new growth forestry folks out of Mendocino County from a commune west of Ukiah.
Greenfield Ranch.
And Mika and Dehinda, Yarrow, and a bunch of folks out there, we all worked on the Barry Glen landslide. And the unique thing about all this was everything we were doing was very labor-intensive. And as Bill mentioned, a lot of it was learned from the Chinese in the 30s and 40s during the Dust Bowl, when the Soil Conservation Service went to China to try and figure out what to do about all the erosion in the Midwest. And they developed a couple of manuals, erosion control on mountain roads, erosion control on mountain meadows. And these things had all kinds of willow waddling and willow fascines and check dams and all labor-intensive stuff. So the park staff, nobody knew anything, not us, not the park, but there were these back-to-the-landers, you know, Bill Eastwood and all these other people out there, Mika, the new growth folks and others. And they brought to the park this idea of doing this labor-intensive approach to treating the erosion. And again, as mentioned earlier, we soon realized, the park staff soon realized, that we had to get big equipment in there to deal with some of the damages from big equipment. And so for a few years, the restoration community went in that area in the park, went very heavy into equipment-intensive approaches. And I'm pleased to see that after 20, 30 years of evolution, we've now arrived at the point where we recognize that almost every project involves heavy equipment and labor, and trying to find the right mix of those two things to do on a project is where we're at in today's world, which is pretty neat evolution. But this stuff started with the back to the landers, because people were out there dealing with their roads and dealing with erosion and things like that.
Yeah, waking up and being there 24/7, year after year.
Well, our whole Hatchbox program was based on, and the program that developed from it was based on, you know, the knowledge and the information that people living in watersheds specifically could bring us. I mean, there were people all over the Mattole who came to the fore when we began this program. People like Ron Lyons and Cullum Coyne and. And ultimately, people
Claire Trower.
And Claire Trower was one of our original heroes, and still is.
Yes.
So, you know, I wish I could begin to give credit to the numbers of people who jumped in when it was necessary to jump in and volunteered to help keep this thing alive. It was a really incredible phenomenon. It was like an idea had been born, and it had been... One interesting question is, why Humboldt? Why the North Coast? Suddenly, you know, restoration was in the air and people all over were doing it. A lot of it had to do with Redwood National Park. Some of it had to do, you know, with Humboldt State being where it was. And a lot had to do with the back to the land movement, that so many people had moved back to the land with the beginning of ecological understandings.
Yeah, and there was, the Committee of a Million? There was like a white paper written by fisheries folks in California that highlighted all the damage that was done. There was like a lot of different things coming together, and it was obvious that just having straight restoration as a volunteer effort wasn't going to cut it. You know, you had to really, and that's back again to that, the economic drivers, like when funding began to come in, that you could actually do significant work, and we did a lot of it really cheaply, I'll tell you that. You know, it was
Richard
really,
can say that with some authority.
You
know. Yeah. Well, you know, it's also interesting to look at the whole political scenario. And you guys talked about some of the, you know, Europeans coming to this area and the logging and all that. And, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, it was the timber companies who ruled the politics in Humboldt County and controlled the Board of Supervisors and a lot of the agendas. And, you know, you would hope that 40 years later things had changed a lot, but in fact, it's my observation that the Board of Supervisors today is ruled by developers. And so it was timber companies before, and now it's developers that seem to control the board and the planning department. And you can look at all kinds of different actions that are happening that will attest to that. And it's just sad to me, because I think Humboldt is better than that and bigger than that, and I really look forward to the day that the Board of Supervisors and the Commission and others really represent the whole community and not just one economic interest in the community. Because without that, we're going to have increased development and another spurt of logging like David was talking about, and we're going to be setting ourselves back tremendously again. Yeah. So it's really important for us to recognize that and get involved and vote and seek out politicians who really represent the community as a whole, not just a special interest.
Well, there's a whole mix of special interests, you know, and the cannabinoids are one of them, you know. I mean, and people trying to earn a livelihood and be on the land, you know, it's much more complicated. And the dominant culture is really colonially based to have a few people control how people earn their livelihood, and that it contributes to them. So it's like, to really get the kind of change that's needed, you just can't give edicts that it'll be this big or that big, and you can do this and can do that. There needs to be something where people can really get into it and actually have self-esteem, earn a living, and all that stuff. And how to do that, basically by your bootstraps in these areas, is a really difficult thing to do. It's like, it just isn't, regulation and all this stuff isn't going to make a bunch of happy campers that have got a self-esteem and a certainty of economic well-being. It's we haven't learned enough yet. So, 7:45, and I hear footsteps or footprints. Here comes Estelle. Okay, let's see. BR, how many people can you have on a line at the same time? We got Bill on and Sun Gnome.
We're asking our engineer.
I can have one more live on the line.
Okay, well, we're expecting Don Allen here a little after 8, and then we're hoping that Mitch Farrell is going to join us, and then Bill Weaver.
Okay.
All right, Estelle.
This is Bill Eastwood. I think I need to go shortly, so maybe I should be one of the ones that gets off so somebody else can get on.
If that's what you feel you need to do, Bill,
we will definitely miss your.
I will be listening, though.
Your voice.
Well, good.
This has been very good. I'm enjoying it.
Thank you so much for taking part in it.
Just part one, Bill.
Your history is an important part of this.
We've got to put this stuff together.
Well, thank you, David, for driving all the way here.
There's no longer a story.
There's a longer story about that.
Oh, okay.
And it's not over yet.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you, Bill, very much.
Okay.
Great to hear your voice.
All right, Estelle.
Estelle, you're on.
Good morning. I'm a number. There we go. Good morning, guys. It's been a very, very interesting morning. And I was enjoying it until I was accused of being a part of a board of supervisors that's controlled by developers, which really is ridiculous, to say the least. And if anybody's paying any attention to anything besides biased journalism, they know that this board is actually, at least from my perspective, very responsive to the community.
There's journalism that isn't biased?
I think Estelle has some history with relatively unbiased journalism.
Yeah. So anyway, you guys, I found your discussion very, very interesting. I applaud and honor all of the work that everybody's done so far, and I encourage you guys to keep on keeping on no matter how long it takes, because it is a community effort. And when you look at the big picture, you know, all along it's about humans living on the earth, and there's more humans than ever before at this point. And so we really need to be conscious, and I think we are to a large degree. And, you know, one of the things that it's, you know, when you're in a position like mine, you get to see all sides of the coin. And, bottom line, everybody's living on and working on Mother Earth. And so, you know, so you've got people up there who are producing industrial-sized marijuana gardens that are doing all sorts of really nasty stuff on the ground as well. And I think we all have to understand that things can be done well. We know how to do them well. And so that's what we need to be doing. And I've been working with some people in the community who've been involved for years and years, including Sun Gnome, and, you know, looking at what can we do to make it possible for people to do the right thing, to educate people, and to help them to come into compliance on issues that are, you know, important.
Yeah. But to be able to earn a livelihood so that you could come into compliance, so to speak. And the thing is, there's been no enforcement of permits or this or that or the other thing for decades, if not millennia. Yeah. In this quarter.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, a lot of it is just people living in the country. And, you know, it's very, very different if you're living in town and you put your garbage out and somebody comes and picks it up, or you turn on the faucet and there's the water. I mean, you just have no connection to what's happening. But let me just say very quickly, because we are talking a lot about land use, that this Tonight at the Veterans Hall in Garberville, we're going to have a workshop regarding the mapping on the general plan update. And this is where the rubber hits the road with regard to what people can and cannot do with their property.
This is sort of one step past zoning or something?
No, it's before zoning.
Okay, so a lot of it is, like, from what I've seen, is in Humboldt County, there's a change from agricultural 40 or agricultural 20 to agricultural residential 40 or 20, and you only can have one unit per 40 or 20.
Yeah. So it's very similar. What happened was that during the last iteration, the beginning, that long, long, long general plan update that I believe did not take as much of the rural living on the land, a reality into account, thank you, or into consideration. We had a group of people who were talking on one hand about the urban model, and the other hand were creating, in effect, to some degree, an urban model by saying that all of the land that people were living on was going to be called rural residential, taking the agricultural out of it. And I talked with Marty McClellan, who was involved with the original 1984 framework plan, and he said they put agriculture in wherever they could. In fact, he said if they could have, they would have done urban agricultural. So because they saw this county as an agricultural county, which I believe to a large degree it will always be. I mean, trees grow fast no matter how people go out there. But I think, bottom line, what we did with the what we did is there, I think there were about over 100, I think maybe 127, if I recall correctly, land use designations, which is a little bit
It's a lot.
And it's confusing, too.
Definitely confusing.
So we've drilled that down. And so within that, places that were called AL or AG or A, no, AG, AL, AR, and things like that have now been changed from that to RA, which basically means residential agricultural, which means basically same as it has been, but says that you can live there, which you could anyway, I mean, it always is. So it's a little confusing. There are changes in the mapping, however, that do change the use of the land, and that's why we wanted people to be very...
Get out there, people.
Yeah. If you got a notice, it doesn't necessarily mean there was a hugely significant change in your land, but land use rights, but on the other hand, it could have. And so anybody who's got a question, we're going to have that workshop tonight at the Vets Hall from 6 to 9 p.m. There will also be a workshop at the Wainema Theater in Scotia on July 6th. And that will be also from 6 to 9 p.m. We tried between Supervisor Bones and my district, very widespread. We tried to hit, so the people from Petroleum might come in here.
David's writing
from,
it down.
People from, good, or go to Scotia, or people from Hydesville or Carlotta could go there rather than come all the way to Redway. But so we gave people two areas that they could come to workshops. And then on the 13th, the historic occasion, we're actually going to have the supervisor's hearing at the Mateel Community Center. And that will be...
That's almost as good as Merle Haggard coming, huh?
So that will be from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., a long day's work for everybody at the Mateel Community Center. All five of the supervisors, CAO, everybody will be there, a regular meeting, and this is a historic event. This is bringing it to the people. This is making it possible for people to be involved because we have a significant number of people living in the area, and they just can't or won't go to Eureka. So
yeah. I think one of the trying to balance things with action and reality, like, for instance, I'm sure there's many places that are in was ag 40 and now is residential ag or whatever. There's more than one unit per 40 acres. Now this goes back to the whole permit grandfathering in, amnesty, all this. There needs to be an adjustment in reality, which involves this topic of restoration, too.
Yeah.
Because people can't live and do the right things for their roads, for their water, storage, diversion, whatever, without heavy-duty education and assistance.
Well, this is the thing, and I really urge people, anyone who's got questions, to come to these workshops, because not only do we have, give people a chance to talk about what changes might be there, we have more planners coming to this meeting than to any of the other meetings in Humboldt County, because we anticipate that there will be a lot of people. So if you do have questions, please show up.
Maybe we could have... You could have a panel of planners, and they could go over their particular perspective.
No. This is not a dog and pony show.
No.
I don't think
Richard was talking about a dog and pony show.
I'm not talking about dog and pony. I'm saying, like, okay, what's your philosophy about planning for Humboldt County? How about your philosophy?
Where are
these planners coming from? That gets into the big
That's a very interesting one. You know, I think that, for some time, there were... Oh, I don't know. There was a feeling that that the supervisors were being led by the planners instead of the other way around. And, you know, and it's a planner's job is to implement policy and to implement regulations and implement laws. It's not to have a particular philosophy about how that should be done.
But nonetheless, often they do.
Well, and so, you know, that needs to be paid attention to. I think that the bottom line, though, is... we've got some very good planners in there now. Rob Wall, I'm really, really like working with him. He is very clear and very knowledgeable, and he will be there tonight. I think that, you know, what people need to understand is that we do live on this land. We do need to know what our rights and our also our responsibilities are. And I think that a lot of people who do live on the land feel that way. I would like to see people feel okay about following the regulations and not feel like, Big Brother's going to come and stomp all over.
Well, there's been a history of Big Brother. You know, I mean, the whole ridiculousness of marijuana being illegal and getting into the bind that we're in here, you know, it's like in the conflicts and all that. And people... have really taken seriously agriculture, whether it's like raising their farm animals or growing really high quality marijuana, you know, and it's like
high quality timber for that.
Yeah, really, recreationally approved in four states now or three or whatever, you know, it's like so many unrealities and conflicts that. Just really
and that actually, Richard, I'm sorry because I don't have that much time, but I want to make a point about what's been going on with regard to the quote-unquote WET program that was established by the State Fish and Wildlife and Division of Water Rights. And I think, you know, there's a little bit of a problem there because you had them trying to, on one hand, trying to work as if, cannabis is whatever, we're just looking at the fisheries, we're looking at the sedimentation, we're looking at how things should be done right. And at the same time, there are people feeling like, okay, I'm going to do everything right. I'm going to get a permit for this and get a permit for that, and still growing more than is legal at this time. And so you've got to get to the point where you understand if you are fighting for legalization, you have to understand, you know, that it's not legal on many levels. It's not legal, and if you're fighting to make it legal, that's good, if that's what you believe. Richard, I think that there are people, let's say, for instance, you look at Sproul Creek. We had a meeting about that. Mm-hmm. There were enforcement agents who came in and found a lot of problems, which are way, way, way too expensive for people to fix without some help. And so what we're looking at is let's find a way to have experts help people do this job.
Yeah,
that's good. That could be one of the missing carrots.
Yeah, I think that there's a whole group of people who are doing that now in this community.
It's a very positive thing that mm-hmm. the marijuana growing community, which covers a lot of people, is more or less being asked to participate now mm-hmm. in repairing our watersheds.
But the thing is, with this questionable legality thing, I mean, this whole water quality waiver stuff, you get tier this, tier that. You know, everybody I know is just going to grow 12 immature plants. So they aren't if you have 12 immature plants or 6 mature plants, you don't have to deal with these water quality waivers, see? Okay. So, but the piece of paper to intent. You had to sign a notice of intent. It doesn't say medical marijuana. It just says marijuana. You're declaring right. How many gardens you got, how many plants, and